funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens when environmental regulation and economic reality intersect in one of the world's richest harvesting grounds for wild salmon? Balancing the interests of government, industry, human communities, and previously unspoiled natural habitats is proving to be no simple task in Russia's remote Kamchatka Peninsula, as science, nature, and travel writer David Quammen explains in the current issue of National Geographic. The article is called Where the Salmon Rule, and David Quammen is here now to talk about what he discovered there and what the future might hold under different scenarios. David, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris. Nice to be with you again.
I'd like to start this with a little geography lesson. Can you talk about where the Kamchatka Peninsula is and what makes it such an ideal spot for salmon?
Yeah, the Kamchatka Peninsula is, it's shaped like a sort of a spear blade sticking down into the Pacific Ocean from the northeastern coast of Alaska, sort of directly across from northeastern coast of Russia, directly across from Alaska. It's as big as Japan, it's as big as California, but it's got only about 350,000 people in it. It's filled with beautiful volcanic cones and forested mountains and very rich, very clean, very productive rivers. And that's where these salmon go to spawn.
And there are six varieties of salmon there.
Six species of Pacific salmon, right. Sockeye, Chinook, Chum, Coho Pink, and Masu. Six species of Pacific salmon in the world, and all six of those can be found on the Kamchatka Peninsula. Actually, about 20% of all the world's Pacific salmon spawn on the Kamchatka Peninsula.
So a lot of that ends up being exported to the rest of the world.
It does now. It didn't used to under the Soviet Union. Most of it went to Moscow to grace the special privilege stores that the Soviet ruling class, the nomenklatura, were allowed to shop in. The caviar, which is the premium product, and the high-quality salmon flesh used to go to Moscow. Now much of it is exported to Japan and Korea.
We should talk for a minute about the life cycle of Pacific salmon. They really are amazing creatures, and I hadn't given it much thought before I read your piece. How do they make their way from roe to fish to actually spawning themselves?
Right. That's really something that is worth knowing about. Pacific salmon are unlike Atlantic salmon, unlike most other species of animal in the world, in that they practice something called semilparity, meaning that they live their lives and they sexually reproduce only once and then die afterwards. So a salmon egg hatches in a headwater stream, say in the headwaters of a river in Kamchatka. It turns into a little tiny fish, a fry. It makes its way downstream hundreds of miles. It goes out into the Sea of Okhotsk, which is between Kamchatka and the mainland. And then it circulates in the Pacific Ocean for anywhere from 2 to 5 years, feeding on tiny microorganisms, shrimp and squid, as it gets larger. And it grows big, strong, fat, healthy. And then eventually it turns around and migrates back to Kamchatka, back to the mouth of the same river that it came from, back up that river to the headwater stream where it was hatched. It goes there to the same exact area where its parents spawned 5 or 6 years earlier, and it spawns once and then dies, and its carcass helps to fertilize the headwaters and complete the cycle and start it all over again.
Do we know why they're able to find their way back to the same spot they respawned?
We don't. Scientists have studied it. They figure it's a combination of some magnetic clues, probably polarized light, to get them back to the river system that they come from. And then as they track their way upstream, it's probably some clues delivered in the form of smell and taste in the water, different subtle chemical signals from one stream to another. But that's sort of informed speculation. Scientists really don't know how it works.
And this concept of semilparity, this reproducing only once and then dying, you call it Big Bang reproduction, because
right,
there is a huge risk and a cost to actually getting back there.
Exactly. The logic of this and the reason it has evolved over the eons in salmon and, as I say, in a few other species, is that presumably the risks of spending those 2 to 5 years in the open ocean and then traveling all the way back, traveling thousands of miles back to the natal spawning area, the risks are so high that once an animal completes that successfully once, the evolutionary balance is such that it's better off to just essentially spawn itself to death, totally exhaust itself with reproductive effort there, rather than take the chance of spawning in a non-fatal way and then going through the whole journey again. The chances are that it's never going to get back a second time, so why not spawn and die the first time?
Now, this is not the case for Atlantic salmon.
It's not the case for Atlantic salmon. They just evolved in a different way. Atlantic salmon go upstream to spawn, come back downstream, go back into the ocean, and then do it again.
How do their bodies change when they go from saltwater to freshwater or freshwater to saltwater?
When they go from freshwater to saltwater, there's a transitional phase called a smolt. And again, I don't think it's entirely understood, but there are certain adjustments that are made so that they can tolerate the salt water, and presumably that involves excreting salt so that the saltiness of their bodily fluids does not get too high. And in most animals, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to do that. In salmon, it's one of the routine transitions that they make, and there's a fancy scientific label for that too. They call it being anadromous, meaning born in freshwater, going to saltwater to grow, and then returning to freshwater.
David Quammen is my guest. His article, "Where the Salmon Rule," is featured in the August 2009 issue of National Geographic magazine. The other interesting thing about that transition is that they face an entirely different set of predators, I would imagine, when they're in the river as opposed to when they're in the ocean.
They do. They do. And, of course, chief among those predators at this point are humans. Big nets in the oceans that that capture salmon on the high seas, and even more effectively netting near the mouths of the rivers as the runs of salmon return, and netting on the rivers as these huge runs of salmon move upstream. I mean, millions and millions of fish going up a stream at the height of some of the runs. It just looks almost as though the river is paved with the backs of salmon.
What happens to the natural predators that exist when a lot of that salmon is taken out of the rivers?
Well, you take the salmon out of the rivers, and the natural predators have problems. For instance, brown bears. There are a lot of brown bears, what we would call grizzly bears, on the Kamchatka Peninsula. In particular areas, they depend on salmon, for instance, for fattening up in late summer and autumn, so that they can afford to hibernate through the winter. The brown bears eat huge quantities of salmon because, of course, they're relatively easy for the bears to catch at spawning time. They wade out into the shallows in the spawning areas and just snarf up these fish en masse. The fish are full and rich with fats and other nutritional offerings. And so bears, eagles, number of other both mammalian and aquatic predators depend on the salmon either early in their lifespan or late in their life when they spawn. Another thing that depends on them, and this is a little bit counterintuitive, is that the plants themselves at the headwaters of these rivers depend on the bodies of the salmon to come back, because if the salmon only went one way, the rivers were always draining these forests and these riverside riparian habitats, then mineral nutrients would constantly be flowing downstream. But the scientists who study the salmon, particularly in Kamchatka, and I spent some time with a couple of them, have discovered that the salmon themselves bring nutrients back up to the headwaters, and by coming there and dying, they replenish nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus, which go into the water, go into the ground, go into the plants that need those that are growing along the headwaters. So if you eliminate the salmon, if you block them from returning, or if you fish them out, then you will be impoverishing your entire ecosystem from the bottom up, and you may not be able to bring salmon back in there later on.
Does the legal sort of legally sanctioned salmon industry in Kamchatka take that into account, the way that fishing affects the ecosystem, or is that at this point not so much a concern for them?
Well, theoretically, they do. There are a lot of fish counters, men and women who their job is to count fish returning to the different rivers in Kamchatka, employed by the different fisheries agencies. And there's a number of different overlapping agencies that handle the awarding of quotas, the controlling of commercial fisheries, the patrolling, the enforcement. There's a welter of different agencies there that control that. And they try and maintain a sustainable, commercially and ecologically sustainable fisheries industry. And it's, of course, possible to do that, at least theoretically possible. And salmon is a wonderful resource. We can protect it and yet harvest it in sustainable ways. People can eat fresh salmon. People can eat salmon caviar without eliminating or seriously damaging these runs, as long as it's carefully calibrated, as long as it's done in a sustainable way that allows enough fish to get back upstream, to spawn, to continue the cycle of wild salmon reproduction, and to deliver nutrients back up to those headwaters. The problem is when the quotas are set too high, or when the quotas are reasonable, but the actual fishing exceeds the quotas. And that's the problem that Kamchatka is facing now.
Yeah, and for people who haven't yet seen the hard copy of the magazine, we should say that there are some wonderful photographs in there by Randy Olson, one of which is of these salmon sort of patrol people working for the government, and they're riding around in tanks trying to check what's going on.
Yes, and Randy does have some magnificent photos, including that one at the beginning of a brown bear peering down underwater to catch a salmon, and you, the viewer, are down there underwater in the position of the salmon. But the enforcement people, they have a very difficult job. They're not very well paid. There aren't very many of them. They don't have as much resources for patrolling and enforcement as they need. Some of them, let me put this discreetly, some of them are quite honest, not all of them. So that's one of the problems. Enforcement is one of the problems. Enforcement against poaching, which is the completely illegal harvest of salmon, either adult salmon or salmon caviar. And the other form of illegal harvest is the exceeding of quotas by the companies that are licensed to legally catch salmon. The Russians have a term for that. They call it Perelov, which means essentially over-harvest, exceeding quotas by licensed companies. And both of those are really large problems. The estimates that I heard ranged around 120 million pounds of illegally harvested salmon per year.
David Qualman is my guest. He writes about science, nature, and travel. His article in the 2009 August issue of National Geographic magazine is called Where the Salmon Rule. We would love for you to join the conversation by calling us now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist David Qualman is my guest. His article about the Kamchatka Peninsula in Russia is in the 2009 issue, August issue of National Geographic magazine. It's called Where the Salmon Rule. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. I think everyone can understand what takes place when overfishing is happening, David, but I have to tell you, it is really, really disturbing to read about the poachers that are simply taking these animals for their roe and then tossing the fish aside.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is very distressing. When poachers go after caviar, salmon eggs, typically what they do is go to a remote backcountry area along the river. They start netting salmon, and then they just strip them open with knives on the bank of the river. They strip out this wonderful, gleaming mass of salmon roe eggs from each female. They put it into buckets or barrels, and they toss the dead fish aside. And then they salt the caviar there in the backcountry. They might conceal it for days or weeks at a time, and then a truck will come in, or possibly even a helicopter, and spirit them out along with, you know, what might amount to 5 tons of caviar from a single little gang of poachers. That means a lot of fish never got to their spawning grounds upstream, never got the chance to reproduce, and that the whole cycle of the salmon run is being short-circuited, being undermined, being leached away by the poachers, and that's a very serious problem.
Is there any way to preserve the meat as well if this is happening, or is it simply that it's just a lot more profitable to only focus on the caviar?
Well, for the poachers, it's a lot more profitable. It's just more feasible. They can take the caviar. The caviar is very valuable per pound. They can preserve it by salting, and they can get it out of there. It's just much more difficult to sneak out thousands and thousands of pounds of salmon flesh. So the poachers, the caviar poachers, just don't bother with that. And the fish carcasses lie on the bank there. Of course, the bears love it, but that's only a small number of bears in one very localized area. You can imagine 4 or 5 bears might get supremely fat on it. But the larger concerns of wildlife, not to mention the salmon runs, are poorly served by that sort of a situation.
And how serious are the penalties for the people who get caught?
Well, it's pretty hard to know. I spent a lot of time going from office to office, as well as going from river to river in Kamchatka. And I didn't really succeed in documenting a single story of somebody, for instance, getting jailed for caviar poaching. Hmm. I suppose it happens. Some of these poaching rings are just a group of private individuals. Some of them, according to what I've heard, are run by criminal syndicates. You know, you hear about the Russian equivalent of the mafia operating in different places. So, you know, these people are, some of them, pretty well wired. And my impression is that aside from a relatively small number of blazingly honest enforcement officers, the system is not working as effectively as we might wish it were.
And without trying to sound like I'm defending poaching in any way, we should say that the pretty much the entire economy of the peninsula is tied to this industry, whether legally or illegally.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when the Soviet Union crashed, Kamchatka crashed hard. It's a difficult place to live. Most of the people there are either ethnic Russian immigrants or the descendants of Russian immigrants. We haven't talked yet about the indigenous peoples, but they are an important group there, but they're now a relatively small group, and they're living essentially on subsistence economies. But the larger economy of the city of Petropavlovsk, of the various smaller towns and cities in Kamchatka, have been heavily dependent on fishing, both legal and illegal. And of course, during the Soviet era, it was supported by by Moscow, and people had jobs. They were paid by the government. The salmon went away to the fancy people in Moscow, but the local people were supported by the government. When the Soviet Union collapsed, jobs disappeared, factories closed, hospitals either closed or became shells of what they had been. Apartment buildings became vacant. I visited one fishing community on the west coast, near the mouth of the Bolshaya River, called Oktyabrskyi, as in the October Revolution. And that was like a ghost town since the changes that had come with the fall of the Soviet Union.
David Quammen is my guest. We're talking about his article, Where the Salmon Rule, in the August issue of National Geographic. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go first to Ryan in Southlake. Hello, Ryan.
Hello. I just wanted to make a quick comment. Actually, this is, a vital issue that's just a subset to many potential issues that exist and coexist because of lack of sustainability practices that we treat our resources and our waterways and our oceans. As I'm aware, there's no real fundamental practice management that tries to deal with some of these issues in a way where you can ensure the product that we consume is responsibly harvested. It would be nice if there was something like that, but it's just as a comment, the best way we can actually combat these sort of contributing to these sort of practices is make a decision to abstain from eating and consuming the resource as a whole. As consumers, that's a first step. It's certainly not an answer, but as this is one of many potential problems that we have in collapsing specific ecosystems and really how our world functions as a whole and its delicate balance. Thanks.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, David?
I think that it's great that Ryan made that comment. Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly, that if anybody cares, if any of us care about these things, the first responsibility is a very basic one. What do we buy? What do we eat? I think that that's very true, not only of salmon, but of any kind of fish or ocean product. I love fish personally, but there are fewer and fewer species of fish that I feel that it's right to eat. I love tuna, but I don't eat tuna anymore because I don't think it's harvested sustainably. I do eat wild salmon from Alaska because I have come to believe that it is being sustainably managed, Bristol Bay and other salmon from Alaska, because the salmon fishermen up there have realized that, look, we want this resource to last through our lives and the lives of our children, so we have to control how much is harvested. Now, let me say a couple of optimistic things, because it's been kind of gloomy so far, Chris. The government of Kamchatka is trying to get a handle on this, just as they've been trying to do in Alaska. They're very aware that these resources are finite and that over-harvest will destroy them. There is one salmon refuge that has been created on the Kohl River, the Kohl Salmon Reserve, which is a protected area for the entire Kohl River drainage on the west coast of Kamchatka that allows sustainable salmon harvest. It's for salmon specifically. It's intended to protect their runs in perpetuity, but limited fishing is allowed. There are a couple of organizations, both international and Russian, who are working to have a number of other Kamchatka rivers declared as similar protected areas, not to say that none of the salmon can be harvested, but that the harvesting will be done at sustainable levels and that the quotas will be rigidly enforced, strictly enforced, so that people are foreseeing and trying to shape a future where Kamchatka salmon could be a magnificent green brand, where we could know that salmon that comes to us or salmon caviar that comes to us with the label Kamchatka salmon is something that we can feel okay about buying. We can enjoy it. It'll be a magnificent product, and we can feel confident that it is not being harvested unsustainably. It's being harvested in a way that allows the local people to make a living and allows the salmon to reproduce.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Speaking this hour with journalist David Quammen. Let's go next to Arlington, where we'll speak with Ed. Hey, Ed.
Hi. Well, I just thought of one brief new point to make based on that last comment. Do you have any plans of giving a radio interview or a talk in Bentonville, Arkansas?
No immediate plans, Ed, but tell me why you ask.
Well, that's where Walmart is headquartered, and if you could get Walmart to push green Kamchatka green salmon, that might be a key to getting that industry off the ground there, getting a sustainable salmon industry off the ground in Kamchatka.
Yeah, not a bad idea. I think the first thing is to get the control on the supply in Kamchatka, get that protected, but then to have people like organizations like Walmart willing to take that as a premium product and market it for premium prices would be a very important part of the whole picture. I agree.
You touched earlier, David, on the indigenous population that is there. And can you talk about the differences in the practices that they use for harvesting salmon as opposed to the commercial fisheries?
Yes, yeah. There are a couple of groups of indigenous people, one called the Itelmen, Itelmen, another called the Koryaks. They've been there for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. They live now mostly in the northern part of Kamchatka. They do harvest fish, not just salmon, but some of the other fish, the herring that run up the rivers also. They use, generally they use old-fashioned fish traps. To some extent they use nets. They use run-of-the-river nets, but individual scooping nets also to harvest salmon and other fish for their own use. They smoke it, they dry it so that it'll last them through the winters. I visited with some Edelman people who treated me to some of their sort of home smoked salmon. That was magnificent. Then they celebrate a festival to a god that they call Kantai, sort of a half fish, half god figure. They set up a totem pole sort of thing on the bank of the river and celebrate an autumn thank you festival to this river god for the salmon. So that is not seriously depleting the amount of salmon runs, these sustainable harvest levels. But those people also would like to be part of the cash economy. They would like to get quotas to set up sustainable fish harvesting operations that could catch larger quantities of fish, could freeze the fish, could export it and sell it and generate a little cash income for the communities. So far, they have not been allowed to do that because of the centralized control and the favoritism for the ethnic Russian fishing companies.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute. So the indigenous peoples of eastern Russia, who I guess at least genetically are sort of the cousins of the Inuit people that we know in Alaska,
right.
Are they marginalized based on their ethnicity, or is it simply a matter of them being so far remote from the centralized government in Moscow in the far western part of the country?
Well, I think it's a combination of those things. I mean, Kamchatka is so far away from Moscow that it's literally geographically marginalized to start with. And the ethnic peoples, of course, are on the margin of the margin. I think it's fair to say there is discrimination in terms of economic opportunities, in terms of hiring practices. They have been, I don't know if they've been forced, they've been encouraged to gather in centralized communities rather than living out in the bush the way they used to. Some of that began during the Soviet era with a way of controlling them. And so they have a little bit of the situation of our Native Americans on reservations. It's not the way they traditionally lived. It's the way they've been required to live as the white culture has come in and taken over and it means that they are marginalized. Yes.
Is there a lot
but
of?
There are also some good Edelman rights and native rights groups that are fighting against these things out of the capital city, Petropavlovsk, and elsewhere.
Yeah.
So they're not lying down and playing dead by any means.
Some of the photographs that appear in the piece depict a wedding, which is a wonderful scene. And maybe, I don't know if you were there at the time that those pictures were being taken, but maybe you can talk about the sort of the cultural mix just within these communities. Are there people of European ancestry mingling day to day with native peoples?
Oh, there are, I'm sure. I wasn't at that particular wedding, unfortunately, but I got to spend a lot of time with the ethnic Russian people and at least some of the Edelmen. I didn't get up to their community for the Kantai festival, unfortunately. But yes, I mean, some of the native people are very well educated. The activists that I talked to in Petropavlovsk, the various different activists, are educated. They're living in the city. Some of them are going back and forth. They're living sort of a mildly schizoid life of educated city dwellers in Petropavlovsk, the capital, who go home for part of the year for the local festivals. I would not say it's a rigidly segregated society by any means, but it's difficult for the indigenous people to bring as large a share of the limited available resources and commercial opportunities to their community as they would like to.
David Quammen is with us. He writes about science, nature, and travel. He has a piece in the current issue of National Geographic magazine called Where the Salmon Rule. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and invite you to join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist David Quammen, whose article Where the Salmon Rule is in the August 2009 issue of National Geographic. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Ed from Dallas asks, what percentage of the world's demand for fish could be supplied by a strictly single-catch fishery? I don't know if you've looked into that or not, David.
I haven't. I have no idea what the numerical answer to that would be. I'm not even sure. I probably should know, but I'm not even sure what he means by single-catch fishery.
My assumption is, and I don't know this for sure, and it's an email, is that it's throwing out one line and pulling out one fish as opposed to using a net or some sort of multiple
probably
capture.
So, unless he means fishing that's done so by whatever technological means that it's really catching only the target species rather than, a bycatch causing, massive wastage of other species, which is one of the big problems of ocean fishing with big dragnets.
Do the people of Kamchatka have sufficient wealth that they're able to actually eat the products that they're producing?
I'd say the quick answer to that is no. Most of them don't. There's a certain amount of salmon, I guess, that's available. Probably species by species. Some of the less premium, the less desired species, you can find it in local markets in Kamchatka. And I assume that at least reasonable number of people can afford to buy it. Many can't. I certainly found fresh salmon, smoked salmon, salmon caviar available in local markets in Kamchatka. Meanwhile, the premium salmon, a lot of the sockeye, a lot of the Chinook was being carefully harvested, frozen, and exported to Japan and Korea.
Can you talk about the genesis of this assignment for you? How did it? How did this become something that you wanted to look at?
Oh, gee, Chris, what was the genesis of this? It goes back over 2 years. I spent time 2 summers ago in Kamchatka, and then I went back again last summer, and that's when Randy Olson also went and did the photography. I have an agreement with National Geographic that I do 3 stories a year for them, and either I suggest them or they suggest them. And they came to me and said, we've heard from a group called the Wild Salmon Center who are working with Russian partners to attempt to create a network of salmon reserves on the Kamchatka Peninsula. Not just the Kol River Salmon Reserve, but reserves on a number of other rivers. If this happened, it would be the most magnificent thing to happen for wild salmon in a long time. Let's follow it. Are you interested in doing the story? And I said, absolutely, yeah, I'd love to go there and find out whether this, in fact, is a disaster unfolding or is a magnificent conservation opportunity and success unfolding. So that's how it began for me.
Is this a matter of international law at this point? Obviously, these are strictly Russian-controlled waters where all this is taking place. Is there anything that the rest of the world can do other than try to dictate behavior through their consumptions?
There isn't much. Some of these salmon are caught in the open seas, and I don't know the fishing rules, the fishing regulations of the open seas, if in fact there are any. But my sense is that it's the tragedy of the commons. There's virtually a free-for-all in the open oceans. Some of the salmon is caught out there. I don't think there's much that we can do about that short of international enforceable fishing compacts on open ocean catch. In terms of the fishing at the mouths of the rivers in Kamchatka and in the headwaters of the rivers, that is controlled by the Kamchatka government and its various fisheries-related agencies. With some influence from Moscow.
Yeah, maybe you can talk a little bit about how much influence the local provincial governments have as opposed to the centralized government. I know a lot of it's changed since the Soviet era, and some people actually believe things were better for the industry when the Soviets were in charge.
Better for the industry or better for the fish?
Better for the fish, yeah.
Yeah, there was one lady who runs a fish hatchery in the headwaters of the Bolshaya River, who told me, I asked her about what was happening with the salmon runs. She said, and this is a very special situation because she's running a hatchery. This is in addition to the wild salmon on that river. There are very few hatcheries in Kamchatka. This is one of only about 5. So this is a small part of the whole situation. But just as the wild salmon are being poached, so her hatchery salmon are being poached before they can get back to the hatchery headwaters, and she's seeing the returns go down year after year. She was very discouraged. She was ready to retire and move back to the city of Irkutsk, which is much warmer than in southern Siberia, much warmer than Kamchatka. And she talked to me about the Soviet Union and the way things were controlled, the way poaching was enforced during the Soviet Union, and the way human lives were regulated during the Soviet Union. And finally, I asked her whether things were better during the Soviet era. And she paused, and she said, well, better for fish, but not necessarily, as she implied, for people.
And I guess the reason that a hatchery can work for an animal like salmon is that it does, in fact, come back. If it's able to make its way, it will go back to the exact place where it was hatched.
Exactly. These are like homing pigeons. You know, the way a hatchery works is that they capture the adults, the females and the males, who are ready to spawn, and they spawn them out into tanks. They mix the eggs and the sperm together, They incubate the fertilized eggs and raise the salmon fry in large tanks until they're about 3 or 4 or 5 inches long, and then release them back into the stream, and they go downstream just as wild salmon would, go to the ocean for 2 to 5 years, depending on the species, and then they come back to the hatchery. At least they do if the poachers don't get them, you know, in between, or the bears or the eagles. It's a sort of this amazing combination of fisheries technology and the hardwired, shaped by evolution, habits and instincts of these amazing fish species.
David, are regular people who are trying to make a living in this region supportive of the idea of protecting these rivers, or do they see sort of the short term as opposed to the long term payoff for setting aside more of these natural waterways?
Well, it of course depends on whom you talk to.
Yeah.
Some people, I heard from some people involved in fisheries that, well, though there are people who live in the mountains, live in the forest, they could get a job, they could work for a living, they don't bother, they simply poach salmon during the summer, sell it, and make their living that way. And these were everyday Russians who were angry at the other everyday Kamchatkan Russians for depending on illegal fisheries harvest rather than finding some other sort of honest work. There are also people, I'm sure, who poach a few salmon just for just to feed their families. That is not the bulk of the problem. The people that are doing that just to feed their families are not taking enough fish to endanger these massive salmon runs. But the commercial poaching and the commercial overharvest do add up to significant, even devastating problems for the salmon runs.
There have been some improvements, I understand, in transportation infrastructure in Kamchatka that ultimately maybe hurt the wildlife there because they make it easier for people to steal this product.
Well, yes, that is part of it, yeah, and we haven't talked about that. I mentioned that this place is as big as California. What I didn't mention is that there are only 200 miles of paved roads in the entire Kamchatka Peninsula. There are also a number of gravel roads, but it's tough to get around. It's difficult to get from one place to another. It's a little like the bush country in Alaska. In Alaska, there aren't that many roads, and people fly around in bush planes, you know, fixed-wing Cessnas and Pipers, and go to landing strips in the backcountry when they want to fish or hunt. In Kamchatka, for one reason or another, there are very few small planes, fixed-wing aircraft, single-engine Cessnas and things like that, and instead you have these remnant, massive double-rotor Soviet Mi-8 helicopters. And if you can't afford to travel in an Mi-8 helicopter, you almost can't get around in the backcountry. And, of course, very, very few people can afford to travel by helicopters. These things are amazing, too. I mean, even National Geographic doesn't have the budget to charter very many hours of these helicopters. But I did spend time in a few of them. I hitched a ride with one of the fish counters, and we flew all over the peninsula. I got a beautiful bird's-eye view of a number of the rivers. These helicopters, it's like, imagine a big yellow school bus with a sawmill attached to the top of the thing, revs up. It sounds like it's going to explode, and then suddenly the school bus lifts off the ground. Now, that's not a very cost-effective way to travel, but it's really almost the only way to get around to many of the backcountry areas. But now there are more roads going into some of these areas. There is a gas pipeline that's being built down the west coast. People are concerned about that. Conservationists are concerned, not so much because they're concerned about gas spills, because with the gas pipeline comes a road, and with the road comes access for poachers.
How long do you think it will be before we know whether the nascent efforts to protect the region have been successful?
Well, I'd say, just as a rough guess, I'd say that if they don't get a handle on it in the next 5 years, the salmon of Kamchatka are in trouble. And yet things are happening. Things are happening on the ground there. There's a number of other further protected areas that are in development stage, in study stage. The government is looking at them. The Wild Salmon Center and its Kamchatkan partners are urging the creation and trying to supply support for the creation of these sustainable salmon-protecting areas. And so I would say to people, you know, watch the news. Watch the news carefully and look for word coming out of this place that you've almost never heard of in Russia, the Kamchatka Peninsula, about the creation of further salmon-protected areas. And if that happens, it'll be a really encouraging, a really joyous development. And maybe then we can expect that we'll start to see sustainable green salmon, not green in color, but green in its conservation implications, available at places like Walmart.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like currently a lot of this product is actually finding its way to American tables. Is there any power we have as consumers to affect the kind of fish that find its way into our markets?
Oh, I think there's plenty of power. When you go to the grocery store, when you go to a restaurant, ask, where does this salmon come from? Is it wild? Is it farmed? Does it come from Alaska? Does it come from somewhere else? Is it sustainable? People who run restaurants, people who run grocery stores, people who run co-ops, the people who run Whole Foods, the people who run Walmarts, can be made to feel some heat by consumers, made to feel responsible for knowing something about the salmon that they offer. So ask that question and be skeptical. Don't just let them say, "Oh yeah, we think that it's wild salmon." You know, ask a follow-up question or two. Where does it come from? Who's the supplier? Can we trust them? Is this sustainable? The consumer has a lot of power in terms of what's ultimately harvested.
Do you personally have a taste for caviar?
I do. I do. I love the stuff. And I ate some of it. I hope that I was eating legal caviar. There was no way of being absolutely sure, but I had the impression that that it was, both in restaurants and in the markets over there. And it's yeah, it's really, really good stuff. The restaurants and the hotels in Kamchatka serve caviar for breakfast with bread and butter. I highly recommend it if you can be confident that it is sustainably harvested.
David Quammen is a science, nature, and travel journalist. His article, Where the Salmon Rule, appears in the current issue of National Geographic. David, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
I enjoyed it again, Chris. Nice to be with you. Take care.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.